The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition, where we're going to do our best to get through more than three questions today. That's the goal. We'll see how that pans out. Some of the questions are longer than others, so we'll see how that goes. But I know Jim's been rifling through the pile over there, finding us some nice informative questions to answer. Informative in that the answers themselves, I guess, are informative. But welcome to the show. My name's Chris, and Jim is here as well. These questions, just so you know, have come in via email for the most part, as our listeners send in emails through our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find a contact form. You can send us in questions that direction. And the questions have started flooding in again, I think mostly because we had an email glitch a few weeks ago where some of them were being diverted to the junk pile, unfortunately. But now that we've got that glitch fixed, we're getting every single one that's sent in, as far as I know. So we've got plenty of things to talk about. And Jim, what's our first question, if you want to dive right in?
Plenty of questions, not enough time. I think we really need, once we get this whole office situation straightened out, dedicate 2 hours to the Q&A show.
Pardon?
You heard me.
Just Q&A show all the time?
No, we do a two-hour Q&A show and a one-hour EDU show.
That's how it starts, and then pretty soon we're just on live all day long talking.
But look at all these questions.
I know, I
People need our help.
Clearly.
Okay. Well, let's see how many we can get to. We got a potpourri of questions. I've got all different kinds here.
Oh, good.
A lot of questions are coming out on a lot of what we reviewed on that five-part EDU show.
Oh.
People have questions on
that. The five-part, why we do what we do and how do we do it. We'll call that the series, right?
Now they have questions on how they should be doing it. So we're going to get to some of those today as well. We got Social Security question. We have a annuity question. We got all sorts of things going on here. Okay. It begins. This one is from a Texan.
Excellent.
And as always, we're going to protect his anonymity, and we're going to call him George. Okay, he begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. Love your show. I have a question regarding your minimum dignity floor. You recommend getting an immediate income annuity to cover for that, assuming I do not have pension and or Social Security. Let's say my shortage is $50,000 at age 60. Let's also assume inflation remains 3%, so by time I reach age 80, if I'm still alive, I now need $90,000 for my minimum dignity floor. How do you plan for that with an annuity? Hmm. Should I buy one at age 60 and buy another one at age 70 and so on and so on? I look forward to your answer. Thanks in advance. Sincerely, George.
Perfect. They're really getting into the nitty-gritty how we do things. So
I thought we talked about that on like the fourth or fifth EDU.
We may not have gotten into exactly how you
do it.
Because
there's no straight answer for any one person.
There's a couple ways to do it, certainly. Certainly.
And I'll let Chris opine a lot on this because he usually calculates it in the office when we're doing the planning. But I think his answer is correct, or it could be wrong. Everyone is different. And it's what we always tell everyone. Now, Chris is going to tell you, listener, you told us, listener, to assume you're 60. So let's just say you are 60. This is not a decision left solely to the 60-year-old you. The 70, 80-year-old you will need to make decisions as well. And that person simply needs the money reserved. So covering a shortage is often sometimes just making sure the older you will have enough money to then decide, should they buy an annuity, a level annuity? Should they buy an increasing annuity? Should they ladder the purchase of the annuities?
Well, let's not get too carried away with burdening the 80-year-old with those kinds of questions, because as you always say, as people age, they're
going to
be...
They may not know it.
So I would keep things as simple as possible for that reason especially, but some decision-making might be made by the older person, certainly. But we always have to be sensitive to the fact that just because this decision might seem simple to quantify and weigh choice A, B, and C to your 60-year-old self, your 80-year-old self may not be in a great position to do that, and a surviving spouse may not be in a great position as well. So I would make sure to leave yourself detailed instructions about why you might be setting aside money that you're leaving for a future decision, and maybe clue in people who might be helping you, maybe kids or financial advisors or planners or that sort of thing, in order to help remind you why or what choices you might be making at 70 or 80 years old. So keep that in mind, too. I'm sure, Jim, it is absolutely true that you don't have to be making all decisions at a young age, but always be sensitive to that degradation of processing power.
Absolutely.
In your brain.
So talk to him about, because he knows his shortage. Mm-hmm. He knows the growth rate of the shortage. So there are annuities that he could consider to address all of that at age 60 if he wanted to.
Right. So the most direct way of attacking this, the way you've defined it, which is a certain dollar amount at 60 and then a increasing at 3% every year, it's actually quite easy to purchase an annuity that behaves that way. The most plain vanilla income annuities are flat in that they pay the same amount every year. So if that's all you have access to, or you've chosen to limit your choices to those only, you would have to do what you mentioned, which is tier them or stagger them in purchasing so that you can kind of replicate the increase needed due to inflation. But there are inflation-adjusted annuities where the annuity payment isn't, in fact, flat. You can purchase a fixed increase every single year. So no matter what inflation turns out to be, it's going to go up by a certain percentage every single year. And it's pretty straightforward to get simple income annuities with annual inflation adjustments in the 0 to 10% range. So the 3% you mentioned is readily available from a number of insurance companies, highly rated. But then there's also annuities that will inflation adjust to a peg like the CPI or another measure.
Just one company, though, offers those.
Not as much, right? So that what that does is it increases the uncertainty for the insurance company. So it's more complicated on their end to leave up in the air what the heck they're going to pay out. It's much more straightforward for them to know they're going to increase your payments exactly 3% every year, no matter what happens. The only variable is how long are you going to be collecting it.
And a lot
it.
So more they, carriers have
right,
those
and
options.
And they prefer that because of the certainty that they're building in. So in the case like he's describing, I would lean towards looking at that possibility and also look at what what's the difference if I instead modeled it more clunky? You know, I call it more clunky because instead of having it kind of gradually rise 3% every year with inflation, so if we graphed it out, we'd see it tracking just perfectly in the forecasts. It's not obviously going to track that perfectly in reality, but it would look great in the forecasts. Instead, look at you buy one for a fixed rate, which is going to cover you for a while, but then when the shortage is a little higher, it may be 70 years old, about halfway, then you buy a second one and pile it on top of there. The advantage to doing that is now the 70-year-old is purchasing part of your income needs, and they'll benefit from mortality credits at that point. A 70-year-old can buy more income per dollar than a 60-year-old can. So, but it isn't going to match it nearly as beautifully as we have this gradual increase. You're going to have what, when we used to approach it this way, and when I say used to, I hate to say that because sometimes we still approach it this way depending on the circumstances. What we would usually do is look over, say, the 10-year period from 60 to 70 and say, well, if I wanted to cover that with a flat amount, what would I have to generate in income from an annuity to pretty much cover that, which means having more annuity income earlier. So actually buying more than $50,000 a year to start, because you know by the time you hit 70, it's going to be too little. But since you're not precisely mapping it or tracking it with an inflation adjustment, you're instead generating a fixed payment amount. In order for you to end up with enough to cover the full 10 years, you are going to have to collect more than you need in the early half, and then to make up for the fact that you won't have quite enough to meet your needs in the second half of that decade. So it's a little more tricky to do it that way, but that is certainly an option.
But I would turn that on its back and look at it a different way as well. And understand, listener, Chris and I look at all of these different options, and no two clients have the same annuity strategy. Mm-hmm. But rather than buying more early, recognize that minimum dignity floor expenses, many of them in there, at least the way we do it, have been smoothed, as we call it in the office. So a lot of your expenses, especially medical expenses with the software we do use, tries to annualize a person's medical expenses over their lifetime, assuming a certain amount of Medicare coverage, a certain amount of Medigap coverage, and they smooth it out. But the fact of the matter is the vast majority of your medical expenses occur in the latter years of your life. And under a smooth, it gives you a higher minimum dignity floor earlier in retirement than you're actually going to experience. So we often tell our clients to recognize this. Do not spend any extra secure income that's coming in, and to make sure you save it because it's going to be needed later. And we go through great lengths to drill this into clients' minds. Well, with that set, that applies a lot when people have Social Security and a pension. So early in retirement, their secure income might be greater than they need. And we often will tell people, well, that's okay because you're going to need it later, which is what Chris said. But what I'm trying to describe is your situation. You're saying you're going to need $50,000 up front. You're going to need $90,000 in, I forget how many years into the future. 20 years into the future. But I would wager you might not need all $50,000 up front. And in the future, you might need more than 90, depending on how your medical expenses goes. So by buying annuities instead of buying more, I would buy less up front. Because the most expensive period to buy an annuity, Chris, is at 60, not 70, not 80. Mm-hmm. They get cheaper the older you get. And interest rates might go higher. They might go lower, as we found recently, but they might go higher as well. Mm-hmm. So he could purposefully start a little under 50 and say, hey, I'm going to buy another one at 67 and another one at 74. But this allows you to look at yourself in the future when you're actually there. What if the 67-year-old you has been diagnosed with a condition and longevity is no longer an issue? You may no longer buy an annuity. So it gives you a little bit of flexibility to do it in phases.
Right. I totally agree. It adds flexibility and some choices along the way to adapt to how your life actually evolves. But this is going to be a choice of that flexibility. Always remember that even if you buy that smaller one to start with, you still must reserve to the side money that you need for future possible annuity purchases, if that's how you're choosing to fund your minimum dignity floor. You can't say, well, I'm going to buy now, then I'll buy some later, but then forget to set the money aside and you end up spending it on other stuff. You can't do that. So you're, even though you're not buying it today, you're still preparing to possibly buy it, which means setting aside the money, and then see how things go. So that gives you the more flexibility, but from a simple standpoint, just getting it over with, buying it and having it set there, that's kind of on the teeter-totter, more in the simplicity approach. So if someone wants to set it and forget it, to steal a phrase from
then
Ron Popeil,
then you can easily do it.
Then you could buy just get it over with. You just rip off the Band-Aid. I'm going to put this aside, essentially admitting that, you know, if interest rates go up and I ended up spending more than I needed to, well, so what? I can sleep well at night because I know it's over and I'm not leaving the 70 or 80-year-old me or my surviving spouse to make some future annuity choice. So that's where the simplicity comes in from the more direct approach. But the tiered approach can be quite attractive. In particular, just recently we dealt with some folks that the tiered approach and individual annuities instead of joint worked much better for their circumstances because of a pretty large age difference. That turned out to create a variable in this whole story.
Yes, if you have a large age difference,
then the joint annuities
and you buy a joint annuity, it's going to be very expensive.
Yeah.
So you have to stop playing the individual annuity game, because putting that younger person on a joint life annuity is going to make your annuity as the older person incredibly expensive.
Exactly.
So you do the first tranche annuity as a single life annuity, perhaps on the older person, and then the younger person buys the second annuity on their life when they're older. Mm-hmm. So that's just another strategy. Now there is a risk there. The first person buys it and then dies right away. So you can have a return of premium or
refund.
Thank you. Cash refund option built in to protect you from that if you wanted. Now we're getting deep into the weeds. The point is, listener, there is no straight answer. You've got to evaluate them all. Work with a good insurance agent who can help you do that, or find an advisor who will help you do that. Look at all your options. Figure out different strategies. Look at different COLA adjustments and what they'll run you. The one company that does offer COLA tied to CPI, I don't know how much longer they're going to do that. Everyone else has gotten out of that. But many, many companies offer a fixed rate of return, usually 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, and just a smitter of companies offer above 5, with New York Life being probably the most well-known one that can go up to 10% annual increase in your annuity payments. So you got to look at your options, figure out what's best for you, what plays into your health, your age, if it's a joint and survivor, all these different things. But hopefully we gave you a few ideas to think of as you evaluate this. Okay, here is another question. I don't want to say similar. It's more of, you'll see. It has to do with Social Security. Mm-hmm. Okay. Kind of tied into what we're talking about, but he's trying to maximize his Social Security income. My wife and I both recently retired. And this is a New Jersey person, by the way. My wife and I both recently retired. I will reach my full retirement age of 66 in March of 2020. So that's now. So happy birthday.
Excellent.
He sent us this email last year.
Okay.
Late last year, I'll put it. So we're not that far behind. My wife is 1 year younger than me. We have pension income and we have retirement funds. Both combined provides more than sufficient income that we do not need our Social Security benefits. I know that we can increase these benefits by waiting until 70, but I fear that the rising populist pressure in this country may one day place an asset cap on Social Security benefits, and we will be prevented from being eligible for benefits. Since it's going to take 13 years for me to break even if I delay benefits, I was considering starting them at 66 because I think it is very likely such an asset cap restriction on Social Security will be imposed over the next 10 years. Am I being paranoid? What do you think is the probability that they will limit Social Security benefits? And when will it be introduced? Well, I can answer the last question first. I have no idea. When will it be introduced?
Or the probability.
Or the probability. One thing jumped out at me before you opine, mm-hmm. and you probably heard me accentuate it. We do not expect to need our Social Security benefits to meet our expenses. He's saying we don't need our Social Security benefits. So I would argue, what are you worried about losing if you don't need them? Now, that said, what I mean by that, I'm not being facetious. I'm saying if you don't need them for your expenses, you need to start looking at Social Security differently and what else it might be able to provide. It's good to know that if your scenario does happen, and I tend to feel it won't, but if it did happen, it's not going to affect you because you don't need your Social Security benefits for your minimum dignity floor.
Right. So this is, I would agree that the decision here is a low paying decision. A lot of people are having to make a Social Security decision that will impact their ability to cover their minimum dignity floor or other expenses. And in this case, at least the way the email is written, it sure sounds like they don't need it to cover any expenses of any kind. Even if they didn't have Social Security, it wouldn't impact them. Now, I would argue, obviously, it's going to impact you, because if you had an extra few thousand dollars a month coming in, you could use that for something, even if you gave it away to charity. There is a use for that money. So need, you know, that's a subjective word, I guess. But they, in their own words, say they don't need it. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. Let me first say that I think the likelihood of people your age and older being noticeably affected in their Social Security payments is quite low. Not zero. It's certainly possible. So I'm not going to dismiss the possibility of what you mentioned. Anything is possible. Things sometimes evolve quickly in the political scene, and the politicians have control over the Social Security system itself. So if things go a certain way, you could see drastic changes there and not protect 60, 70, 80-year-olds. I find that very unlikely, simply because historically, when there's major changes to programs, they protect people that aren't in a good position to protect themselves. Older people just don't have a lot of wiggle room. They can't change the way they have lived their life. It's too late. So I think you're mostly protected. That being said, if you're outrageously wealthy, you could get certain people in control that would attack that. So I'm totally leaving the door open that that could happen. As far as the best claiming strategy, I would look at what else could you use that money for? If it's for a really good purpose and you turn it on now, and maybe if it makes you feel better, that's a worthy reason to turn it on now versus later anyway. If you just feel better because you're convinced that this is happening, that this is going to happen, and the likelihood is a lot higher than I believe, you might be right, and you should turn it on right away. What's the harm in that? Well, the harm in that is your lifetime benefit. If you live past that 13-year break-even point that you referred to, and I don't know if yours is or not, I'm just going by your words, then your lifetime benefits will be lower than if you had delayed. That's really the cost, but since it doesn't really impact you that much, I think the pain on that is low. And you're clearly very worried about what you described, and the way to alleviate that is to turn it on and start receiving immediately. Where I'm really concerned about people turning it on early because of the reasoning you provided is that they put too much weight on that reason, the worry that something like that might happen, and don't put enough weight on the jeopardy that they're putting their long-term retirement plan in by making that choice.
And that's where I was going to go.
The people that turn
that
on at 62 or something, because they're worried, they read all the,
and they sell
all the headlines,
short.
And they undermine themselves financially, and they don't realize it until they turn 70 years old, and they're looking around trying to figure out why the heck don't they have enough money to meet their minimum dignity floor, and it's because they turned on their Social Security too darn early. I am really concerned about a decision in that environment. That's not the case here.
No.
The case here, I think if you're worried about it, turn it on.
Exactly.
The pain, the possible damage to yourself is so minuscule, and you could find lots of good things to do with that money, even if you give it away.
And what I was going to go with on that, because you wrote that, listener, you don't see a situation where you're going to need that Social Security money. So I'm assuming you projected forward. You feel your pension and other income sources is going to be more than enough. You know your expenses. Chris and I are assuming you factored all that in. Because you wrote that you don't need it, to me, it doesn't matter if you wait or turn it on. And I'm actually leaning to having you turn it on. Mm-hmm. Number one, it's going to make you feel better because you do feel over the next 10 years that a populist movement will start going after people like you, people who were successful and have amassed a certain amount of assets. In other words, you're worried that they're going to means test Social Security and cut your benefit, if not eliminate it. I don't see that happening, but I cannot say for certain it wouldn't. So turning it on, Chris, would alleviate that fear of his. Mm-hmm. And the lower Social Security benefit won't affect him like it could seriously affect other people who needlessly fall, I don't want to say prey to this line of belief, because some people truly do believe it. And you and I don't know if it ever would or wouldn't happen. But what I'm intrigued with instead, I don't know enough about your situation, but goodness, start using that Social Security number then to improve everything else. What am I getting at? I'm assuming someone who has large Social Security benefits and a large pension may also have a good amount of money in an IRA. Start looking at what happens under the Secure Act when you and your wife pass away and your children inherit those accounts. They cannot inherit Social Security, but they can inherit your accounts. So collecting Social Security will limit what you might need to take from your IRA accounts, mm-hmm. and start using the government's money, the Social Security money that you're saying you don't need, to give right back to the government in taxes on Roth conversions. Now, you got to be careful about IRMA limits and all these other things, but start doing some calculations if you are looking to help your children avoid the loss of the stretch IRA. That's one option you could do. Mm-hmm. But another more intriguing option, and you might be a little less inclined for this because, number one, it involves insurance, and most do-it-yourselfers have been taught to hate insurance for some odd reason. But it also is going to be dependent on you receiving Social Security forever, and you don't think you will. But I would be more intrigued, Chris, with taking that extra Social Security of you and your wife. If you're looking to optimize an inheritance to your children, rather than spending it on taxes on Roth conversions, plow the after-tax Social Security money. So you're going to take care of your taxes first that you're going to owe on the Social Security. Plow it into a second-to-die guaranteed universal life policy. We've opined on those policies before in the past, where those policies are a lot cheaper than individual permanent life insurance policies on your lives. You combine both your lives into a second-to-die policy funded with premiums that with income that, in my opinion, will last forever. I don't see them taking it away from you, but again, we're not saying that couldn't happen. But you see where I'm going with this, Chris. He could plow that money he doesn't need, the after-tax money that he doesn't need, into a second-to-die guaranteed universal life policy, even if both you and your wife are in your 60s, you will be able to perhaps get some really good leverage, maybe $1 million, $1.3 million, $1.5 million, $1.8 million, of a guaranteed inheritance, tax-free, that could be left to a trust, could be protected for your children. That liquidity could be used by your children to maybe pay the taxes on the IRA that they might inherit. Or you could then take that IRA, leave it to a charity tax-free, leave it to a donor-advised fund that maybe you want to create in your name and your spouse's name that will be funded at the death of the second spouse that will allow your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to be appointed to that donor-advised fund, almost acting as a foundation at this point. It would receive your IRA 100% tax-free. Your children get the life insurance 100% tax-free. And now they can serve on the board of this charitable foundation, essentially, that you created. And they can give money. And it teaches those future generations that you may have met, but they would have been very little before you passed away. It teaches them the ability to understand gifting and charitable intent. And they can also continue to give to groups and causes that you find important. But they get to serve on the board and help give that money, all tax-free. Because you claim Social Security and you started using Social Security that you don't need towards other aims. And that's what intrigued me most when I read this. Now, I gave a very 30,000 foot view of something that needs to be analyzed at 1,000 feet or even closer. But you follow some of my concepts here, listener. Look at that free Social Security, if you will, and if you're certain you don't need it, leverage it. But also look at what's going to happen when you pass away if you have children and what's going to happen as they inherit or they can't inherit Social Security. Now, you could take your Social Security and buy investments with it and let them inherit that, but there's no guarantee what those will be worth. With the life insurance, there is a guarantee what it's worth. It's growing tax deferred. It will be received tax free. If it ever comes back that they change the estate tax rules and lower the exemption amount from currently $11 million back down to $1 million or so per person, you could transfer the ownership of that life insurance policy to an islet. And as long as one of you live at least 3 years after the date you transfer it, that second to die policy will be also exempt from estate taxes. So it gives you a lot of flexibility that your other just leaving it in an investment account will not give you. But I also like the idea of then taking your IRA, leaving it to a donor advised fund for charitable intent, or giving it or putting it in a charitable remainder trust that would pay out your children, assuming they inherit it over the age of 40. The numbers work perfect at that point. They could be receiving 5% of the value of that IRA you left to the CRT for the rest of their lives. And then at their deaths, the remainder would go to charity. All sorts of flexible things you can do because you don't need that Social Security.
Right. So if you haven't built any of those things into your plan now, this might be unlock the door to doing some of these more interesting things with it, since you clearly, at least by your own definition, don't need it for your other expenses that you've forecasted.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah. This one was an interesting question, this next one, mostly because I had this conversation with the Ed Slot group just out of my own. We didn't get a question on this. I was just wondering one day, how the heck would this work? And I started communicating with the professional consultants in the Ed Slot group. There's three of them. And as a member, I get access to them. And this confounded them. And they finally said to me, we don't know how this would be viewed because the IRS has never ruled on it, but your frame of mind and thinking on this, Jim, makes sense and might be the way the IRS looks at it, but they also said, we are not going to go so far as to tell you that's how they're going to look at it. So and then when I got this email out of the blue, I thought, holy moly, this is exactly what I was talking to them about. So It begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. I'll try to keep this brief as I can. I'm aware of the pro rata rule when making a non-deductible contribution to a traditional IRA and the converting of it to a Roth. However, does the pro rata rule apply in the following scenario?" Why don't you explain the pro rata rule as it applies to a Roth conversion with after-tax basis is where this guy is going.
Okay, so in a traditional IRA, you can have two kinds of money in there. You can have tax-deductible money that you have deducted when you put it in, which means you opted not to pay tax on that income. Remember, what the dollars that go into an IRA are income. You have to have wages from work in order to contribute. So that's the assumption. That's the source of them. They're going in there, avoiding the taxes if they're deducted, those contributions deducted. That's the traditional way. So the money that's in the traditional IRA has not yet been taxed. But the other type of money that can be in there is money that you have already paid tax on. We call it basis in regards to a traditional IRA. We use the word basis in a lot of different areas of finance, but in this case, we're referring to your traditional IRA basis as those monies that already have been taxed. And you might say, why the heck did someone do that? Well, it's because the earnings, at least, then get tax deferral status. Even though the contribution didn't go in tax deferred, it's the earnings that occur while it's sitting in there are going to be tax deferred. So there's some reason for that. And people can either choose to put money in that way, or they might meet certain income thresholds where they're not allowed to deduct the contribution to their traditional IRA. And that's how that money gets in there. So let's pretend you have put in, to keep the numbers really simple, $10,000 total into your traditional IRA. $5,000 of it you deducted when you put it in, so it's gone in there pre-tax. So when it comes out, it must be taxed. The other $5,000 you didn't deduct, so it's had already the taxes paid on it. So when that money comes out, there are no taxes. So in the future, when money comes out of this traditional IRA, that original $5,000 that you paid tax on will not be taxed again. That's good because you don't want double taxation. The other $5,000 you deducted and any earnings on the whole $10,000 is going to be subject to tax as it comes out. That brings us to the Roth conversion. A Roth conversion, you are taking money out. It's not a traditional distribution in that you're taking it out to spend it, but you are taking it out and putting it into a Roth, which for tax purposes, it treats it the same as being you taking it out to spend it on living expenses, for that matter. So when you take money out of the traditional IRA, they want their taxes at that point. You're essentially volunteering to pay the tax on that date so that once it gets in the Roth, in the future, if you make qualified distributions, those will not be taxed. So that gets us back to the complexities with the pro rata rule. The pro rata rule says that as you take money out of that traditional IRA, you can't pick and choose the dollars that come out. It's going to come out as a mixture of pre-tax and post-tax money, pro rata by how much each of those buckets represents inside the traditional IRA. So let's pretend there's no growth in there. So all that's in there is $5,000 of tax deferred money, another $5,000 of after-tax money, and you immediately then do a Roth conversion of the whole thing, of the whole $10,000. When you do that, it's going to come out pro rata. Even if you only take $5,000 out, it's going to come out $2,500 pre-tax, $2,500 after-tax. So you're going to owe tax on half of what comes out in my example, because inside the traditional IRA you had 50-50. You cannot, under the pro rata rule, control how it's coming out. You can't say, oh, no. I only want to take out the $5,000 of after-tax money. Or, oh, I want to take just the $5,000 of pre-tax money. You're not allowed to do that. As it comes out by rule, it comes out as a mixture, what Jim and I refer to all the time as coffee and cream, right? You mix it in there, it's just all mixed in there. So when you pour it out, when you take it out of the cup, it's going to come out mixed together. That's the pro rata rule.
Now, that is correct.
That was a lot of words.
That was a lot of words. That was like Jim's example.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to be pithy. one thing I do want to add, let's take this one step further, listeners, for those of you who don't quite understand. Let's pretend in Chris' example, you had $5,000 of never taxed money in an IRA 1 and $5,000 of after tax money in IRA 2. Hmm. And then you took IRA 2 and thought, well, this is after-tax money. I can move this to a Roth as a conversion, and I'll owe no taxes on it because it's after-tax money. So you move that $5,000 into a Roth. The pro rata rule says all your IRAs are considered one big IRA, and you would still owe taxes on half of that $5,000. Because in the eyes of the IRS, half the money that went into the Roth was pre-tax money, and half of the money was after-tax money. So keep that in mind. It's germane to this listener's question. So now that you understand the pro rata rule, and for those who already knew what the pro rata rule was, we're sorry, but many of our listeners didn't, so Chris had to go on that 45-minute tirade of what
easy,
it was.
Easy.
Okay, so he says, let's say an individual has $100,000 in a traditional IRA. He positions the $100,000 into a single premium immediate annuity, still inside an IRA, and begins receiving income. Well, that would make sense because it's an immediate annuity. Mm-hmm. Income would begin immediately. Mm-hmm. His traditional IRA is now with his traditional IRA with his custodian is now showing a zero balance.
Yep.
His income obviously exceeds the amount allowed to make a direct contribution to a Roth. So this, by the way, is from an advisor. That's why he's talking about not himself, but someone else. He's saying this person now makes too much money to put money into a Roth, but he doesn't have an IRA anymore in his example. Mm-hmm. He's saying, can he now do the back door without getting snagged by the pro rata rule? This came from another financial planner, folks. Let me explain what he's asking, because this is the same mindset that I had when I had this discussion with the Ed Slot group quite randomly several months before receiving this email. I was thinking to myself, what if we're trying to help someone do a back door? A back door is when you earn too much money to put money into a Roth. So you want to take your contribution that can't go into a Roth because you make too much. You're going to put it into a non-deductible IRA because anyone can put money into a non-deductible IRA so long as you have earned income. Doesn't matter how much you make. You could be, I can't use Bill Gates anymore. Who's that rich dude now that owns Amazon? Bezos.
Jeff Bezos. Yeah.
You could be Jeff
Bill
Bezos.
Gates is still rich.
Yeah, but I think Bezos is richer than Bill. Who would you want to hang with, Bill or Jeff?
I think Bill's cooler.
Bill's cooler?
I think so.
All right. We'll hang with Bill. He could still pick up our tab.
He has better hair, too.
True. Very important to you.
Apparently.
So, back to what I'm trying to say. So, you have a situation where someone makes too much money to put money into a Roth, mm-hmm. so they are going to put a non-deductible contribution into a non-deductible IRA and mm-hmm. then convert it. Mm-hmm. In this advisor's example, he's saying, hey, my client has this big IRA, and because of the pro rata rule, the back door won't work because he has, in his example, $100,000 in an existing IRA. If he put $7,000 into a non-deductible IRA and then converted that seven, the pro rata rule would say, Chris, a large percentage of that conversion,
it's going to be taxable.
Probably mm-hmm. over 90%. I can't mm-hmm. do yeah. the calculation in yep. my head, would be taxable. So he's asking, if I took that IRA and moved it to a single premium immediate annuity IRA, mm-hmm. could we now
do the back door?
That, Chris, was the exact scenario I laid out to the
SLOT. I thought this was
going
to have something to do with the SECURE Act. It doesn't.
Has nothing to do
no,
with SECURE
No, this has nothing
Act.
To do with SECURE Act. So,
the Ed Slot group
I like
and
where
I
you're going with this.
Got into a deep conversation.
Yeah.
And my opinion, listener, yes, you can do it.
That would be my opinion as well.
Not the opinion of the Ed Slot group.
But this they is the said IRS convert.
The Ed right. Slot group actually started yeah. researching this, and yeah. they said, there is no guidance on this. Mm-hmm. Here's my point, folks, why I think it would work. Mm-hmm. The annuity this guy used This is a smart advisor. He didn't buy a variable annuity. He didn't buy a fixed annuity with an account balance.
Right.
He bought a SPIA, single premium immediate annuity, inside an IRA.
Yep.
So the moving from one IRA to the SPIA, tax-free.
Yep.
Once it gets to the SPIA, even Natalie Choate has said this, and Natalie is as smart as Ed. Both of these people are incredible. But Natalie pointed out to us, and you were at this seminar she put on, Chris, when you annuitize an IRA, which is governed by defined contribution rules, it immediately becomes a defined benefit and is governed by those rules. And my argument to the Ed Slot group was, yes, it's an IRA annuity, but it's governed as a defined benefit plan. And if you have a pension paying you out a pension benefit, you're not subject to the pro rata rule.
No. Plus, for RMD calculation purposes, that IRA gets set aside as its own animal, and those annuity payments for the SPIA to qualify to be in there, it had to pay out such that it meets the RMD requirements
under
law.
And that was the second point.
And there is no account balance anymore.
I pointed,
and the RMDs that are required by that particular IRA are 100% satisfied by the SPIA payments themselves, but the excess payments can't be applied to cover RMDs from other accounts.
And that was my argument with the Ed Slot group. I said to them, according to Natalie Choate, once that became annuitized, it is a defined benefit plan, and the IRS is specific. Even though it's an IRA, we're going to hold it to a defined benefit plan rule, and that states the benefit you receive, the pension benefit, or in this case, annuity benefit you receive, the payment you receive every year is deemed to be the RMD for that account and that account only.
Yeah.
So as soon as you moved it to a SPIA IRA, it becomes a defined benefit plan. And to me, I said, if the IRS isn't going to let you take that SPIA payment and apply any excess, which would be quite substantial, because your first RMD is only 3.7%. And a SPIA payment for a 65-year-old is close to 6%. And a 70-year-old would be close to 7%.
Yep.
You cannot take that excess payment and reduce your RMDs on another IRA.
Right.
So how can the IRS say there is an account balance that is subject to the pro rata rule? Not only that, once you annuitize, it's irrevocable. There's no more account balance. You don't get an annual 5498, a copy of a 5498 at least. The IRS doesn't get a 5498 every year from the custodian saying, hey, this is the current account balance of this SPIA. There is no account balance. In my opinion, listener, I think you would be okay doing this for your client.
So did the Slot group disagree, or did they just say we're not going to go so far as saying yes?
They, the second.
Okay.
They said, Jim, we're not going to agree or disagree with you. They did say, we feel you have a strong case, but there's no guidance that they can go to and say definitively, that's how the IRS would
view it. Write back to this other planner and say, please do this.
And then pay $20,000 and get a PLR for us.
Run it up the flagpole at the IRS and then let us know what they say. Then we'll all know.
I tell you, I feel extremely confident this could be done.
Yeah,
how could
think so
the
too.
IRS argue? Yeah. How could the IRS argue you have to use this as a pro rata situation, but also argue you can't use then the excess to reduce the RMD?
I can't see that happening, but, you know, this is our opinion. We have to leave open the possibility that the IRS would say we're wrong. So if someone tries it and it works or doesn't work, we'd love to know.
I would try this in a heartbeat.
I personally, if it were me and I was put in a position where this made sense, I was trying to accomplish this, and the only way for me to escape the pro rata rule. By the way, let me back up and say, you wouldn't do this simply to avoid the pro rata rule. You'd have to have an overwhelming reason to speotize, which isn't a word.
I'm assuming they needed more guaranteed income.
Right. So this isn't a, oh, look, let's do this so that we can avoid the pro rata rule. That's not going to be the reason.
Buy a spia for that reason.
The avoidance of the pro rata rule is just a side effect that could benefit you as well by speotizing this IRA in this particular case. I totally agree with Jim that I think it's highly likely this would work. I can't see them ruling a different way, but it's always possible. And when we do a PLR
But the quizzes, Internal Revenue Code, as Natalie Choate pointed out, is explicit. Mm-hmm. When you take an IRA and annuitize it, not with a deferred variable annuity with an account balance or a deferred indexed annuity or a deferred fixed annuity, not with any type of annuity with an account balance, with an irrevocable decision that you no longer have an account balance, you have an income stream. The Internal Revenue Code is explicit. Defined benefit plan rules apply. And there's no pro rata rule with the defined benefit plan.
I agree.
And there's no account balance for the pro rata rule.
I don't know how you'd even do it, even if they said you could.
And you can't use the excess money to offset other IRA RMDs. So how could the pro rata rule apply?
Yeah.
I think you would be fine doing it, but I loved this question when I got it, because I was like, I was bored. And I was thinking of this, and I just started.
Because we've had other shows where we've figured out how to separate the cream from the coffee, and we didn't list this one as an option. So we got to add that to our next.
But we're not
100% separating the cream from the coffee, and we'll put that in a special category of maybe this would work, but we like the possibilities.
And listener, you are a financial planner. A private letter room is only $20,000.
Yeah.
So if you want to be famous.
Yeah.
At least in our industry?
Let's say this was the George, maybe it's George. This could be the George rule.
The George rule. You could become the George rule, because I ain't paying $20,000 for this.
For the gym rule?
No. Yeah. But isn't that's what sickens me with private letter rulings. You've got to pay the IRS to give you an answer, and they want $20,000 to do a private letter rule.
You think the person who doesn't like you using the hell word is going to be okay with you saying frickin'?
What's wrong with frickin'? That is not a swear word.
Not technically, but we all know what you're replacing there.
Yeah, freak.
Oh, okay.
What did you think I was replacing?
A different F word.
I wouldn't know what you're talking about.
Okay.
Franklin?
Yeah, Franklin, that's what it is.
Fabulous? Okay, I've been given the scene from my admin, Laura, that I have to get going. I have a meeting. And that's why Scott's sitting here.
Oh, they're trying to drag you out of here?
Yes, Scott and I have a meeting to go.
Well, I can wrap this up.
Do you want to answer Social Security questions?
Well, we're in it over 50 minutes. We're pretty much to a full show at this point.
It's up to you.
No, let's save those.
Okay.
This was even though it was only three, these were three good questions.
I thought so.
This is a good show.
Okay, so hopefully, at least to us it was.
Yeah, if I don't say so myself, right?
I have no idea if other people are going to like it. But good questions. I especially like that last one only because it intrigued me. And again, I think the strategy would work, but there is no guidance. And we're not going to get guidance until someone does it. And then, ask for the private letter ruling before you do it. And
You can try it and then ask forgiveness and then let us know what tax court says.
I think it works. I don't even think the IRS would know it. Because
there's no balance being reported. Yeah, they're going to look around for a reporting of a balance, and they're not going to get it. And it's not like you're pulling one over on them.
There's no
by them
balance.
Not hearing about it, and you just keep it on the down low, and you're hiding it from them. That's not what's going on here at all. There is no balance.
It is impossible to get a current account balance on a SPIA because it's an irrevocable decision, and it's now defined benefit rules.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyways. That's it. We will be back next week with hopefully more than three more questions, but thank you for attending this show. Chris is going to talk to you real quickly about a little pause we have going on and things going on with the office and then how to get questions to us, but I do have to run with some of my staff to a meeting.
Perfect. So this is the point in the show where we normally remind people that we are living, breathing, practicing financial planners in Northern Colorado, which we are and still are and plan to be in the future. But we have, let me revise that as particularly popular living, breathing financial planners in Northern Colorado. So right now we are in a growth phase, and we are hiring additional planners for the office because we got an overabundance of work. And so we've put a pause on taking new clients. We will be taking new clients in the not too distant future once we increase our ability to handle that demand. So if you're looking for financial planning help, we'd love to talk to you in a few months, maybe. But right now, if you've got questions, we're more than happy to answer questions. We're going to keep doing the podcasts. And to send in questions, the way to do that is go to the website jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And on there, there's a contact form. You just fill that out, fill in your question. The more concise and direct you are, the better the chances are you'll get the answer relatively soon. And there's no tricks, really. There used to be a trick during football season. Jim had this weird process where if you mentioned the Patriots in the subject line, he would bump you to the top of the list. But that doesn't work anymore for a variety of reasons. I think maybe next year we'll try. If you mention the Patriots, you'll be put at the back of the list. But we'll maybe have to run that by Jim. He's not here to disagree, so we'll just go with it for now. But for those of you who are listening, want to send in a question, jimhelps.com. And we really appreciate these questions because it gives us nice stuff to talk about. And we had three pretty good ones this time. So if you stick around with us next week, we'll be here with a brand new show. But we really appreciate your listening, and we'll talk to you later.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.